As you listen to our next story, keep in mind that the Vatican once infamously persecuted one of the world's greatest astronomers, Galileo, for saying that the Earth revolves around the sun, a finding that was, of course, correct. Now consider that this Thursday, the American Astronomical Society Division for Planetary Sciences will award the Carl Sagan Medal to a Vatican astronomer for making scientific learning engaging and understandable. Guy Consolmagno, a Jesuit brother raised in Michigan, will become the first clergyman ever to win the prestigious award. Consolmagno joins us from Arizona Public Media in Tucson, where the Vatican has a telescope and where he will be receiving his medal. Brother Guy, welcome.
It's great to be here.
And I want to confess to you that I didn't realize the Vatican had astronomers or even had an observatory, but I'm guessing I'm not the first person who's been surprised like that when they meet you.
Well, that's the whole reason we have it, is to surprise people.
So what kind of work do you do, and what happens at the observatory?
There are a dozen of us. We have one fellow working on string theory and cosmology. We have another fellow working on meteors and trying to observe what they're made out of and where they come from. We've got people doing spectra of stars, people doing the formation of galaxies. My own work is meteorites and the formation of the solar system.
Why is the Vatican involved in that at all? Why not leave it to other scientists?
Well, it's a long history. You know, we go back to reforming the calendar in the 1500s. And since then, astronomers, especially Jesuits, have been involved in teaching astronomy and doing research in astronomy at all the different universities they run. But especially in the late 1800s, in 1891, Pope Leo XIII decided that he wanted a national observatory for the Vatican. And it served two functions. One was political, to show that the Vatican was an independent country with its own observatory. But the other was to show the world that the church supports science. And it's interesting, this came up in the end of the 19th century, because that's when the myth began that the church was against science. Before then, most people realized that, you know, either you're a nobleman or you're a clergyman, because who else had the education and free time to do science?
Do you find yourself having to defend, in a sense, the church and its views on science sometimes? I mean, particularly when you consider the whole Galileo incident, you know, the church persecuting Galileo for saying that the Earth revolves around the sun, and of course having to apologize and say that was correct hundreds of years later.
Right. Well, of course, what people don't realize is that's basically the only example they've got. Because even in that case, the church reversed itself on the science, you know, within 100 years. And beyond that, I find today that most scientists understand that the church supports them. And indeed, when I became a Jesuit, you know, I sort of came out of the closet, I'm a churchgoer, I discovered so many of my friends and fellow scientists were also churchgoers. To me, the big mission we have is to convince the people in the pews that science is good. If I'm a missionary of anything, I'm a missionary of science to the religious.
This perception that still exists among some people, however, that the church is a little resistant to science, is that something that's frustrating for you to keep having to try to dispel?
It, in one sense, it's frustrating, of course. On the other hand, if it weren't for that, I wouldn't have a job. So I'm really enjoying what I do.
Brother Guy, you have a really interesting background, I think. You grew up in Michigan, Metro Detroit, is that right?
That's right, yeah. Went to a Jesuit high school there.
And then went to MIT.
And then MIT, yeah.
And then at what point did you become a priest?
I didn't. I became a brother. And that's an important thing to keep straight, because the Jesuits have both priests who are ordained and go out and lead religious work, and brothers who take the same vows and live in the same communities, but we work for the community, not for ourselves. I didn't decide to become a brother until I was nearly 40. At that point, I'd, you know, done research. I'd been in the big leagues at Harvard and MIT. I'd been in the Peace Corps and taught overseas. I finally thought I'd found my niche by working at a small college, Lafayette College in Pennsylvania, which I loved. And I thought, okay, this is the time to decide what I'm going to do with my life. I'd been dating a girl, and that didn't work out. And okay, now what am I going to do? I'm pushing 40. So I looked into the Jesuits thinking that I could teach at a Jesuit university, you know, Marquette or Boston College. Instead, you know, one of those vows I told you about, the hardest vow is the vow of obedience. Under obedience, without asking me, they ordered me to go to Rome, eat that terrible Italian food, look at that boring scenery, and, oh yes, work in a papal palace with a collection, a wonderful collection of meteorites.
Huh. So you found a way to satisfy your religious interests and your scientific interests simultaneously.
Except I didn't find the way. It all happened by happenstance. Uh-huh. I certainly didn't plan this in the least. You know, it's one of those miracles that makes you wonder, maybe somebody is watching upstairs.
Tell us about your research specialty. It includes meteorites?
It is meteorites and the connection between meteorites and asteroids. Now, when I was growing up, it was right after World War II. You remember they were building lots of tract homes, and I was in one of those subdivisions. You'd go in the backyards, and you'd see the junk pile, all the stuff left over from building the house. And you could tell what was in the house by what was in the junk pile. The asteroids and meteorites are the junk pile of the solar system. By studying them, we can see what's inside the planets, and you even get a feel for what conditions were going on when the planets were being formed. The one thing that we've contributed in our work at the Vatican Observatory is that we've done a survey of measuring physical properties so that if you're interested in doing a model of how planets form and you want to know, well, what's the typical density of this kind of meteorite or that kind of meteorite, you look it up in our tables. You want to know their magnetic properties, you look it up in our tables. It's taken 20 years to make the tables we've come up with so far. This is the kind of work that no one else could do because no one could get funded for 20 years to do this. But since we don't have to worry about funding, we just saw this is a kind of work we can do that we can contribute to the field.
From your description of meteorites as the junk pile of the universe, I can tell you're a teacher and probably a good teacher because you have a nice way of explaining that.
Thanks.
The title of your book is a question. Would you baptize an extraterrestrial? Do you have a yes or no answer to that personally?
The short answer is only if she asks. Because, in fact, we don't want to say that there are definitive answers. Science is not about definitive answers. Actually, neither is religion. In both cases, they're conversations about the questions that stay with you all your life. You know, I could ask myself, do I have enough money to buy a candy bar? That's a yes or no question, and it's boring once I know the answer. But I could ask, what is it about candy? What is it about chocolate that's so wonderful? And I can live with that question and explore new ways of understanding chocolate for the rest of my life. The really good questions are the second kind.
I came across an article about you in the Catholic News Service, and it said that you have no doubt that life exists elsewhere in the universe. In your view, could that just be amoeba, sort of single-cell organisms?
Oh, well, I have doubt. You can't help but have doubt. I certainly hope it's out there, and it's a big universe. It sure would be a waste of space if we were all alone. But I would really expect in the next 100 years we find amoeba or something like that somewhere in our own solar system. I don't know if in 1,000 or 1,000,000 years we'll actually find intelligent life just because the distances are so enormous. But we don't know. We don't have the data. And so it'd be crazy not to look.
We've been talking in a way about how you reconcile religion and science. And I've read that you have said that religious questions give you the framework that gives you the motivation to ask science questions. What do you mean by that? What's an example of that?
Well, you know, when I was younger, when I was a postdoc at MIT, I wondered, why am I doing astronomy when people are starving in the world? That's why I went into the Peace Corps. The people in Africa reminded me that asking these questions about the stars and our place in the universe is a really essential part of being a human being, because we don't live by bread alone. Well, that's a religious belief. It's because of these beliefs that I have the courage and the motivation to do science, recognizing that it is, in fact, an act of worship.
Guy Consolmagno is a Jesuit brother who this week will be awarded the Carl Sagan Medal. It's one of planetary science's most prestigious awards. Brother Guy, thanks for talking with us.
It's been a delight.